This is Tom Fishburne, also known as the Marketoonist. He's built a successful business drawing cartoons that illustrate the humor and absurdities of the corporate world.
It's become one of the largest collections of marketing cartoons out there. So
you've kind of got the market cornered.
It's a bit of a niche, that's true. In a way, the name Marketoonist that I created is a bit of my own unique job description.
Tom has been creating these cartoons for over 20 years now, has over 500,000 followers, and has been trusted by big brands such as Google, Adobe, Pepsi, and many more.
You're a natural. Suffice to say, how do you structure your day to get the best creative work out of yourself?
It's hugely important. Most creative people I know start by...
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zier, and today we're speaking with Tom Fishburne, also known as the Marketoonist. Tom initially built a career as a marketing executive, but all the while, he was developing cartooning skills, poking fun at his industry, eventually quitting his job in the late 2000s to do marketooning full time. So Tom, we're going to start detailed. I understand that you have essentially four revenue streams, the largest being these are sort of married bespoke brand campaigns and cultural consulting for said brands, then speaking gigs, and lastly, people paying to license your cartoons. So we're going to start with that one, which are about 10% of your revenue. It's the smallest portion, correct?
That's right. That's right. But it's been a stable passive stream of revenue since the beginning.
Okay.
And it's become one of the largest collections of marketing cartoons out there. So it's a useful part of the business.
Probably the largest. I mean, I can't, when I think of marketing cartoons, I can think of like other people who've done one-offs and such, but you've kind of got the market cornered, at least with the name.
It's a bit of a niche. That's true.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about the pricing. On your website, alongside every cartoon, there is a shopping cart button. And the prices are, when you hover over that, $40 if you're going to use this for a presentation, $125 for a newsletter or website, $60 for a corporate blog or sponsored post. And then there's a button you can click for FAQ, which also includes this note that sharing cartoons in your personal blogs and social media is free and appreciated. So how did you price these and how long have they been priced at this level?
So like every way that I found ways to make money at what I do, it was a bit responsive. Basically, people started to ask me very early on if they could use the cartoons in various places. And initially, I or my wife would reply to every one of those inquiries. It got to be a little overwhelming. So I wanted to make a very simple way for people to license for the three most commonly requested items. And make it as simple as possible. A lot of the image licensing websites at the time had so many exhaustive options for licensing an image. It was like this gauntlet that you had to run just if you wanted to download it for a presentation. You had to pick what country it was in and what the audience size would be. It was just overwhelming. So it was easier just to give up and just use the cartoon without asking for permission. And ultimately, I realized that's what I was competing against in this moment. People just saving the image or screen grabbing it and using it anyway. I wanted to make it as easy as possible. So I just picked those three because they're the most common ones. I still get a lot of licensing requests beyond those, particularly book publishers, people using them for corporate ad campaigns and those types of things. And those are all more custom quotes that we have conversations around it because the value tends to be a lot higher. But for those three, it felt right at the beginning. Over time, I've occasionally benchmarked off of whatever else is out there, the New Yorker, et cetera. But ultimately, I've nudged it up over time just because it's been going on for 23 years now. But I wanted it to be reasonable enough that people who were getting value out of the work were paying for it, but not so excessive that people would just give up and decide to just take the image anyway.
And steal them, yeah. That's my next question is, how do you deal with unlicensed usage? I mean, it's the internet. We would go back as far as Napster, whatever. Any given media on the internet is constantly being AI. That's a whole nother conversation of, data that's being put in for the machine learning. How do you deal with unlicensed usage?
Everything, I've operated since the beginning on sort of a good faith principle. I don't go chase people down. Generally, if people feel comfortable, just copying the cartoon and putting it in a presentation, I'm not going to wave my hands around. But I generally, after publishing the cartoon for so long, I have a nice relationship with my audience. I try to remind them that, it's a way to keep it going. I don't charge for a subscription fee. You know, it's just a, it basically covers the cost of operations. The one time I do get involved is whenever I see occasions where people are taking the cartoons, changing them, or putting their logo into them. Or in some cases, I've seen cases where people have taken a collection of my cartoons and actually tried to redraw them in a different style. Those types of things, whenever I come across those, and usually I come across them because somebody sends them to me. Hey, I saw this and I recognize that as one of your cartoons. Those are only the only occasions I really sort of intervene. And in those cases, I don't make a federal case out of it. I just send them a polite note on LinkedIn. Hey, I saw this. Would you please, you know, respect the work and only share the cartoons as is. And by and large, it's been fine. I mean, there, like you said, it's the Wild West and things happen. I had to kind of decide to pick my battles early on. And ultimately, it's important for me to reach an audience and not have to have too many points of friction in reaching the audience. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be fairly compensated for my work, which is why I made it really simple to use the cartoons that I create every week. And then ultimately, from a business perspective, my biggest focus are deeper, more meaningful collaborative campaigns. And in those campaigns, those issues don't come up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the stakes are higher and you're doing much more custom stuff for them. I think the thievery, the changing, the words, that kind of thing. I talked to another person about a year ago, Pejman Milani, who he makes illustrations and he's also quite popular on LinkedIn. He said a similar thing. It's kind of just you send a note and pretty much 9 times out of 10 or more people are like, oh, you got me. Sorry. Won't do it again. Like a little slap on the wrist, right?
I try to assume goodwill. And in most cases, even when people are doing that, they appreciate the work. They just don't fully understand it. And so I always just approach it from that, you know, very a mutual respect level.
Yeah.
And genuinely, when I do that, I usually get a nice response, even from some of the more egregious cases.
Yeah.
People have responded. I across the totality of my business, I have to decide where I'm going to place my efforts. And it would be easy to spend hours a day, you know, spinning out on those types of issues. I've just decided I'm going to focus on just creating the next cartoon or doing the next deeper collaboration.
This reminds me, kind of as an aside, this reminds me of something I saw about 5 or 6 months ago. I was interviewing another person and I'd seen her being part of this conversation. So we brought it up where this writer using Substack had posted how she was kind of angry that the New York Times, a writer at the New York Times, had quoted some of her work, had built on some of her ideas, and, you know, quoted her and linked to her work in the piece. But it was this kind of like anger that they would do that without asking her, which I just bring up as a way of saying like, these kind of like usage rights. And like, when is it okay to use someone? That's obviously like a quote with credit and somebody's ideas, which when it's like writing is quite different than like an illustration you're just copying. But I don't know. It just strikes me like how confusing, how blurry the lines can be on like on usage and like engaging with other people's work on the internet.
Yeah, there's a gray area for sure. I just always try to operate. Ultimately, the core of everything I do is this connection with the audience. Mm-hmm. And I fortunately, over 23 years, with some minor exceptions, it's been a pretty deep and meaningful relationship.
Yeah. What do you mean by minor exceptions, if you don't mind?
Well, examples like that where people might take the cartoons and drop their own logo into it and have it promote whatever their company is without asking. By and large, most of the times that where I see my work connecting with others, it's, you know, the respect is returned.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so going into a larger chunk of your income, you've said that you make most of your money through these more custom brand deals combined with consulting, which might be external marketing campaigns, perhaps a series of cartoons, or often to, which this is really interesting, the internal cultural work, whether it's like a manual or whatever. And then this is often also married with this consultation on humor as a leadership skill and surely more things. But you've said that this has been north of 50% of your income for basically the entire decade and a half that you've been doing this full time. Tell me more.
That's
about
right.
This.
Yeah. So that really was the initial business model. The paid speaking, which I also do, came later. I didn't know that could be a business, but that actually that was near 50% last year. So it's really between the two. I'm spending a lot of my time in those areas. That also came from by demand. My first request came from the Asian edition of the Wall Street Journal. They asked me to create a bunch of cartoons for them to create basically a cartoon book on how to get the most out of the Wall Street Journal. That was the first light bulb moment for me because I had a day job in marketing And here they were using cartoons to create as a marketing piece. And I charged them a per cartoon rate. And I realized through that project, I had my pricing model all wrong, because actually the value that I was bringing was that I was also a marketer. So I was giving them pointers and suggestions on how to use the piece. And that that really created the impetus for the whole idea of the business, that I have a marketing background and a cartooning background. And if you put the two together, there's a lot of value in cartoons as a medium, but the marketing strategy is part and parcel with it. And so a lot of trial and error went into it. I mean, it was on the side of my day job, a pretty busy day job. And I would get these requests from companies asking if I would create marketing campaigns for them. And in the early days, I was pricing on that per image rate and benchmarking off of things like the Graphic Artists Guild. They give pricing sheets on what a custom cartoon is priced at typically on average. And one of my clients afterwards came up to me and said, I really like the work that you created for us, but you're thinking about yourself all wrong. You need to, you know, you went to business school, you should know this, but you should be pricing on the value you're bringing my business, not just based on a cost benchmark. And so putting all that together, I started to think, what could I charge for a campaign? How could I think about the pricing for this? And so I was kind of experimenting with a bunch of clients on the side, up into the point that I was ready to leave my corporate job to focus on this full time. And at that point, I had structured pricing that was meaningful enough, I can imagine starting a business around it. And it was creeping up to about half of the, my income was about half of the salary I was making at the time. And that gave me confidence to finally cut the cord and make a jump into that business full time. And since then, it's been a case of experimenting with different ways to make that business work.
Yeah. So at that point, we can cover this briefly. When you left, I think you had around 100,000 subscribers or so to your newsletter, correct? Which you'd been doing for about a decade at that point. I might have those numbers wrong.
It was less than that. I've always focused on having high open rates and a smaller audience rather than the audience side. I can't remember what the size of the newsletter at that point, but it's been closer to around 50,000 today.
Okay. Well, but suffice to say, you had a lot of very engaged people. And I think that you'd been sort of building this up for a while. I really like this detail that I think it was sometime in the early 2000s, you had joined General Mills, and there was around 30 of you who started at the same time. And you'd been doing these, these kind of for fun doodles, almost you could call them at that time, where it's just for fun, kind of just for you. You'd done them for the Harvard Business Review newspaper when you'd been there, and you decided, hey, I've been doing these cartoons about our work. Do you want to be on this list? And it was this BCC list of 30 people. Yeah. And I understand from there, it was kind of this, I mean, in the earlier 2000s, I think of I was 10, and I was born in 1994, so I'm 10 in the mid 2000s, right? Yeah. But I can think of my aunt forwarding me things like this, right? And this is the kind of thing that circulated a lot then. So I imagine that's kind of where the bulk of your, or maybe not the bulk, but the seed of your audience came from, that kind of email virality back then, right?
100%. I never did any additional outbound push beyond that. But I did add things as they came along. I started blogging in 2007, and I started adding social media as those channels emerged. I kind of saw all of those different new channels as opportunities to get my work in front of more people. Mm-hmm. But at the very start, I kind of saw the cartoon and my newsletter and eventually my writing that went along with it as the core. And I tried to be kind of platform agnostic about all the different ways that it would reach people.
Yeah.
But in those days, that was one of the benefits, I guess. There wasn't as much of that going around. There were a couple of emails that you could subscribe to. I can't even remember the name of the first platform that I used for sending out emails once I moved beyond the BCC stage. But it was before MailChimp. Yeah. And so I was just
before Gmail even.
Yeah, it was before Gmail. It spread really quickly. I started to get people signing up very quickly. Within a few weeks, it was hundreds and thousands, and then thousands, and then it kind of grew from there. But the open rates were always really high, and I decided I would commit to a weekly cadence of sending them out every Monday morning, and then just see what happens. I didn't have any aspirations to monetize it at the time, and I think that helped. Mm-hmm. Because it allowed me to focus on why I was doing it to begin with, which was I wanted to create these cartoons. I wanted to connect with people. It made me feel a little bit less alone in my day job to realize others out there in the corporate world were experiencing the same things and laughing at the same things. And so I just kept focusing on that first and foremost, And then from that first email in 2002, it was 8 years before I left my job in 2010. And so it was a slow, steady, but fulfilling run up to that point.
You were developing this thing. I mean, I think that's a key part of it, right? Is it's this competency, but also this sort of playfulness that it was this outlet for you. This is the part where I always have to ask people how they define the term creator, which let me preface this. And we talked a little bit about this before, too. I think you obviously started this before that was a term. It's really a term that dates to, I forget if it was like 2011 or 2008 when YouTube started really using this, right? And then now it means so many different things. And that's part of my job on this show is to figure out what it means. But when I first came across your work was 4 years ago or so. And we were looking, I was at this job and we were looking for marketing influencers to collaborate with. And you came across, we're like, no, we can't afford him. But my point is like, you maybe predate this idea of the creator, but it also maps to a little bit what you do. That's enough from me. Tell me how you define the term creator and if you identify with it.
Yeah, I've always felt conflicted with the term largely because I hear it sometimes used as, I want to be a creator, and then let me just figure out what I'm going to create. Whereas for me, that always felt like the cart before the horse. I always wanted to create, and then it was, how do I create more of this? And so I've always used as a term for myself, I'm a cartoonist, I create cartoons. But as I watched the creator economy evolve, I instantly felt a kinship with all of the tactics and tools and platforms and approaches that were being used. It made me excited because I would often come across people who felt the need to create something, and we would occasionally have conversations about whatever it was, and they would ask for my advice. And because at the time, my own journey was a little bit unique. And I think a lot of journeys, it's not one size fits all. Ultimately, we kind of have to find our own path to it. I couldn't give a playbook. I could only describe what my experience was like. But as I saw the broader creator ecosystem and kind of trend emerge, it helped give me a little bit of clarity to see how what I'm doing might fit into that bigger shift and trend. And so I don't quite have a definition for a creator, aside from make your own definition, come up with your own job title of what you are, that's what type of creator you are. In a way, the name Marketoonist that I created is a bit of my own unique job description. Mm-hmm. I had to find out what I uniquely did. There are other cartoonists out there. There are other marketers out there. Marketoonist was a way that I could kind of find a definition that worked for me. There's this great Jerry Garcia expression that or quote that you don't want to be the best of the best. You want to be the only one who does what you do. Mm-hmm. And so that helped. It helped it for me to define it for myself and make it my own. And that would be my you know, as others think about, you know, what creator means for them, figure out what that definition is for them. Yeah. For some, a friend of mine described it as the power of combinatory skills. You take different skills in your background, you put them together, and that makes you uniquely you and what you want to communicate and express to the world. I think that's a good ask for everybody when you're getting started, not to look at, oh, I see somebody being successful over here. How do I do that? But instead think, oh, what is true about me? How can I use all these tools available to create something that's uniquely mine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a couple things in here. One, I like the way you're defining it as like really, you know, putting it in other simple terms, what's your unique value proposition? What are your unique skills and points of view as a person? The definition I like to put on creator is in the digital sense, because that's what we talk about here, right? Is anybody creating content for creating digital content for distribution online for an audience beyond their friends and family that they're trying to build in earnest? And then three, monetizing it somehow it's directly or indirectly, whatever. But the way you're talking about figuring out like, well, what is the thing you do? I listened to your Do lecture from 2011, I believe. And you quote Bob Minkoff, New Yorker cartoon editor, saying it's not the ink, it's the think, which I think is a really important thing for any type of creative work. And it's what you're talking about here. And I think about myself as a child being like, I want to be a writer. When I'm like seven, I wanted to be an author. When I'm in high school, I wanted to be a journalist, right? And now I write for a living, and it's a bit of all of it, right? But the point is, I also think of like kids now, I think YouTuber is the number one job kids want to be, right? But the point is like, you can want to create the thing, and that can be the appeal, but that only gets you so far. That gets you the doodling, that gets you, you know, the mimicry that we were talking about a little bit earlier. But that only gets you so far. You only really make the leap once you start having the actual idea. And then it's about picking the medium and studying the medium that is correct to distribute the ideas you have, right? So I really like this. It's the ink, not the thing. It's the ink, not the think framework.
I do too. That resonated with me a ton. And I think when he described that, a lot of it had to do with finding your own style. There's some, you know, nice thing about the nature of cartoons is it's sort of a hand-drawn medium. You know, there are computer tools and ways to do it, but you have your personal signature on the cartoons that you're created. And sometimes someone like James Thurber, who would draw something scratchily with a messy ballpoint pen, his approach was the best way to execute that idea rather than somebody who was a fine draftsperson. But I think that you can extrapolate that further to everything you described, that it's about remembering that you're using the tools to an end and finding, putting your emphasis in the right place.
Yeah. One more note on mimicry. This is again from that talk you gave, the Do talk. And I was thinking about this as you were describing people stealing your work and changing the words and such earlier. You described as a kid using Silly Putty to copy your favorite newspaper cartoons to other paper and then replacing the words, which obviously the difference here is that you were just doing that as a way to learn and have fun as a child, not as somebody trying to, you know, build an audience or make money on the internet. But I guess my question is, how important do you think that kind of mimicry is in creative work for developing that taste and executional skill?
Oh, when you're starting, it's hugely important. And I think most creative people I know start by in some ways copying aspects of their heroes. Mm-hmm. There's a line between rote copying and then being influenced by. But in the early days, experimenting and mishing and mashing all these different styles of people you're influenced by is a big part of the process. I've heard it described as like the early days of creating stuff. It kind of looks like a Frankenstein monster where you have these parts from different influences. And over time, the stitches disappear and it kind of becomes your thing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my work has been influenced by other cartoonists for sure. It's how we do it. The difference between what I was describing when someone's dropping a logo into one of my cartoons, it's not the same.
They're
as
not
being inspired by my work.
Yeah.
Yeah. and so there is a line there, I think. But being inspired by the creative work that's out there is a big part of the process. But ultimately, to keep it going, certainly with any longevity, you have to find something that's true to you and that's your true expression.
On July 16th, four of the biggest names in the creator economy, Sean Puri, Cody Sanchez, Chris Kerner, and Tyler Denk, are coming together for the Creator Business Summit. They've built seven-figure brands, scaled audiences, and turned content into companies. And now they're breaking down exactly how they did it. Whether you are just starting out or scaling fast, this free, live, and virtual event will give you the playbook to turn your audience into a real business. Don't miss it. Visit beehive.com/virtual-events to register for free. That's beehive.com/virtual-events. This brings up another thing that I heard you, I forget which podcast this was, but you were talking about how, or the person was asking you why there's no consistent characters in your work. You have, you know, this style, but there's no like Calvin and Hobbes, right? There's no Calvin, there's no Hobbes, there's no core character. And you were saying how you were inspired by Gary Larson, one of my favorite cartoonists, and how his effort was to create this single panel joke that worked on its own independently. And, you know, the characters might kind of look the same, but it's not the same guy or the same cow, maybe in his case every time. Right. And how you like, so what I'm interested in asking you about here is like this idea of like using these props to tell a story versus the idea of using repeated characters to tell a story. How you think about that?
Yeah, I think characters are incredibly valuable, and I know a lot of cartoonists who use them. I feel like having something that's recognizable over time, particularly in a cluttered world, is key. For me personally, because this came out of something I wasn't really thinking strategically at the start, I preferred the idea of not being hamstrung by thinking I want to communicate something. I have to think which of the characters I have would best communicate it. I started thinking because one week I would write a cartoon about social media and the next about sustainability and the next, you know, technology. I wanted to have free rein on it, however I wanted to set up that idea. And I love the Gary Larson world that one minute you're in a cow pasture and the next you're on a planet somewhere with you know, aliens in a spaceship. I love that kind of flexibility personally. So that was sort of a self-motivated direction. And I realized over time that my drawing style became something that was recognizable. While I don't have identifiable characters, I do hear from people like, oh, I know that's one of your cartoons. Or occasionally when somebody does take one of my cartoons and takes my signature out of it and posts it with their own logo, people are like, I know what that is. That's one of Tom's cartoons. So I found that my own signature drawing style became a recognizable, repeatable reference point so that people would know it was me and was mine. And I leaned in that direction. But there's definitely room to play with consistent characters over time. In some ways, I'm glad that I didn't, because the characters I would have come up with in 2002 might seem stodgy when I'm writing about, you know, AI, for instance. The marketer in the cubicle, I still, you know, reference, and it's part of what I work on, but people aren't often working in cubicles or open plan offices. You know, people have changed over time. And I always found it a little bit silly whenever I would see like an old Dagwood Bumstead cartoon, you know, a character that was created in the 1930s. And suddenly, somehow Dagwood Bumstead is in a modern day office talking about email or whatever. It just seemed like discordant to me.
It makes sense.
And so I preferred the great flexibility of like, I am designing one piece at a time and I'm going to use whatever tools at my disposal help communicate that one idea. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, I want to make sure I have my signature on it.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking a little bit ago about how when you started, there was exponentially less content on the internet, period, yeah. Right? Let alone quality content, really thoughtful content. There was just exponentially less. Now it's so competitive. One of my beliefs about the creator economy is that in the same way that, you know, 15, 20, over the last, let's say, 25 years, this kind of refrain has been learn to code, whether you're a kid in school or, you know, young person or just a mid-career person trying to shift jobs, it's learn to code. Now I think that's less so with the rise of like vibe coding and these tools like Cursor, et cetera. But my belief is what's replaced that is marketing, and like with everybody participating in the creator economy, you get an edge by quality content. Sure. But like everyone has kind of become more sophisticated and better at marketing and gaming these platforms. What I posit to you is that marketing is kind of the core skill in the creator economy now, and it's so hyper competitive. What do you think?
It's definitely a core skill. I think I talk to a lot of creative people, and they're frustrated when I tell them what the typical day looks like for me and how much of it is not actually at the drafting table, because I think I often frame it less as the marketing part of my job and more a bit as the entrepreneurial part of my job. It's finding new ways to find audiences. Some of that involves marketing and some of that doesn't. One of the early words I wrote down before Marketunist was being a cartoonpreneur. And that was more of an internal motivated term for me of how I saw what I did, that the state of play was always going to be changing. And I couldn't continue, you know, one year after the next doing the same thing over and over again. I had to constantly be aware and open to new opportunities and try new things out, try new business models, try new platforms, continually experiment. And so a big part of my day, you know, was that. How can I get in front of audiences that way and evolve over time? And I feel like every artist in some way has to be entrepreneurial, because the traditional, particularly in cartoonings, the platforms of newspaper syndicates aren't what they used to be. You can't just rely on an intermediary to do that for you. So I focused on bringing that in-house, kind of owning that part myself. Part of that is marketing, to be sure. And I think we have to know the platforms and think about how we're reaching the audience. I knew that, as you said, it's getting more cluttered, it's getting more competitive, and I'm never going to be the first mover on all of these different things. And so by the same token, I wanted to do a few things well rather than try to do everything. And so the email newsletter, the humble email newsletter, has been my platform since 2002. And I love that in a way it's such old school tech, because as things continually evolve and there are new opportunities, and I certainly have enjoyed experimenting with them. I've seen great opportunities with LinkedIn, for instance, and reaching an audience. At the end of the day, those are platforms that I have very little influence over. And the algorithm giveth and the algorithm taketh away. And you might have, you might be up this month, but next month, you know, you're from hero to zero. And so I decided that I would rather focus on a few things and truly ultimately try to have a connection with my audience that I prioritize above all else. And I go other places, you know, and I've been told again and again that I'm missing opportunities. You know, when blogging emerged, they said, "What, you can't blog if you're not blogging once a day." And I'm like, I have a day job. I can only do it once a week. And most of the people who gave me that advice have long stopped blogging. So I've learned over time that you have to kind of trust your instincts. There's a lot of faddish nature to what's happening. A lot of chasing bandwagons and shiny object syndrome. And so I've tried to stay true to myself, be open and be entrepreneurial, but try ultimately to focus on where I can have the greatest impact, which is with a direct audience if I can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I fully agree that the email, I mean, if you have somebody's email address, that's kind of the least mediated form of digital communication, right? No platform. I mean, there are platforms in between, whether it's like the tool you're using to send it or the inbox they're using to access it, right? But it's much less mediated than any of the others. What do you make of the Humble newsletter, as you said, kind of having this resurgence? You could say it never really went away, but I think over the past 10 years, when like the Skim and the Hustle, Morning Brew, up to now with like your Beehives, your Substacks, it's such a thing. What do you make of this medium and how it's changed in the 23 years you've been sending a newsletter?
I've loved it as a medium. I love that it continues to be a medium. In some ways, the clutter effect is the part that I find I'm most watchful about. You know, people could sometimes subscribe to so many newsletters, they forget how many there's, you know, there's a clutter factor certainly in the newsletter economy right now that I pay attention to. Because whenever anybody says, "Oh, this is where we all need to be," if I'm in that place, I start to think, that means that there are a lot more people in the pool. And so I watch that. But I think ultimately it's a validation of a trend that, there's the connected audience aspect of it, but I think there's also in a way, it's a counterbalance to the algorithm push of all the rest of social media, you know, particularly something like TikTok, where you just, it's wired to see what you're going to engage with, but it's not necessarily what you want. You can spend, you know, an hour on TikTok and get off it and just feel exhausted. And where did that hour go? I've always been more of the mindset. I know that my buttons can be pushed in certain ways. So I'd rather not put myself in positions for my buttons to be pushed and instead be more deliberate about what I consume. Partly because I've learned I really need to be structured about how I spend my time in different things to really do what's meaningful to me in the long run. A lot of algorithm heavy social media feels like empty calories to me. Whereas when I subscribe to a few people I really want to hear from, I feel like there's more nutritive value in that.
Mm-hmm. I 100% agree. You are what you eat. That's especially true with information, with media, right? Talk briefly about these platforms. So you're on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, probably some of these others, but those seem to be your core platforms. On LinkedIn, this is your largest following by far. You've got 422,000 people there, 60,000 on Instagram, 37,000 on Twitter. LinkedIn seems to be a good investment for you. How has your relationship with these platforms, like specifically these three, gone over time? You just talked more broadly, but specifically these three.
Yeah, even as those platforms emerged and I saw success there, I still saw my newsletter as the core. So at the early days, I was literally just taking my cart in and I'm like, fine, I'll put it there. My audience is there. They want me to be there. I'll put it there. My LinkedIn audience is actually, in a way, people were looking for me personally, but then they're also looking for my company page. I was a little late to that. People were like, where's the Marketoonist LinkedIn? So now I've since added that too, and that's another 60,000. But I was late to realize people were looking for that as well. So I was sort of like out of sight, out of mind for a lot of those. I was on autopilot. With LinkedIn, I started to realize that's where the interesting discussions were happening. In the early days, when I had an email newsletter, I would direct people to my blog, which I still do, but I had a comment section on every blog post, and they were really interesting, provocative, commentary at the bottom of every one of my cartoons. You know, 30, 40, 50 comments with people giving their own personal stories and examples. The internet ecosystem changed, and some of that's bot-driven. I turned blog comments off a while ago, and partly because I realized the interesting conversation was happening on LinkedIn, where people had to have their own identities there, or, you know, it's harder to have a fake identity. And people were actually posting more substantive, interesting commentary, and I enjoyed reading it. I enjoy reading what people will write about my cartoons or whatever post I've written every week when it's in LinkedIn, because it's connected to their identities and they have more skin in the game. So then I started to think, oh, this is a place I want to spend more of my time. And I had a lot of success with LinkedIn, I think, because particularly in the early days, there wasn't anything like cartoons there. Now, you know,
now LinkedIn, there's LinkedIn creators.
Yeah, exactly. And it didn't exist before. So they pretty early on named me sort of their top voice category. And I saw a lot of algorithm success from that. And my audience grew. But I decided to just keep focusing on what was working, which is, putting my material there, my cartoons, my article, and then engaging a bit more with people who are responding to my work there. So that's really where I see the closed loop of being able to see what people thought about each cartoon, or I saw this in my situation, or have you thought about drawing a cartoon about X? That's really the only bit of social listening I do is in LinkedIn comments.
This is a big source probably for your ideas, right? Because I think you've only been doing Marketoonist for about 5 years. You were consulting for this company for a little while that ended around 2019. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you do more consulting, but that's something I wondered is like, if, you know, for a long time, for many years you worked in marketing and it was very easy to get these ideas, to get inspired in your day to day. Whereas if you are sitting in your home office here and not interfacing with coworkers complaining about these things every day, right? It might be harder to get ideas. So is that something that's been harder for you as you've gone more full time and just Marketoonist, or are you just finding ideas on social media?
Yeah, it's evolved. Part of it, I still see very much what I do as working in marketing, because I'm working with all of these clients and developing marketing campaigns. It's just in a way I see myself less client side and more agency side for that part of my business. And I learn a lot from their experiences in a wider variety of industries than I ever did before when I was just working in consumer packaged goods. The other benefit I find from doing keynote speaking is I get to travel and be at conferences and meet people in person and hear stories from them. I get a lot of ideas on the road that way. I got to 8 countries last year speaking. And so, you know, I was at the Cannes Advertising Festival. And I was scribbling notes the whole time. I went to a conference in India. I was scribbling notes the whole time. And so I find being a cartoonist has helped me learn how to listen and observe better. And so when I drop in those environments, I fill up sketchbooks full of starting points for ideas. When I'm talking to clients, I fill up sketchbooks full of potential starting points for ideas. And then that's all raw material to work from. And so I don't, it is different than working day to day in an office with colleagues, but I see the same level of inspiration everywhere that I did before. But to your point at the start of it, LinkedIn is one of those channels. Like I get inspired by things. Somebody will share something happening to them. And particularly, you know, as AI has been emerging more and more, I'm not inside an organization trying to grapple with the organizational change that comes with these new tools. And so learning by other people's experiences and how they're talking about what it's like for them tangibly to how their job is evolving, how they have anxieties around those things. I'm picking up a lot of cues from some of that LinkedIn commentary.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about your work with clients for a little bit. So I think I heard you say this in another podcast, how you eventually, it took you a while, but you eventually got better at saying no to projects. And at first, of course, it's like, you know, you're building this up. And so you're quite grateful for any work. And then you start getting more, you know, rigorous around your pricing. And eventually you start being able to say no. And, you know, I've been on both sides of client work as an agent, as a client, and figuring out that brief and how much leeway, how much leash to give people, which I'm of the belief that you give them a few details and let them do their thing. And that's kind of why you chose to work with them, right? But a couple questions in here. First, what are the red flags that cause you to say no to a potential client project?
Yeah, I've gotten better at this. It was harder in the beginning, partly for the reasons you described and partly my own imposter syndrome. I wasn't comfortable standing up for myself. And creative work is very personal. And so it's hard to find those sorts of boundaries. But it has gotten better. And the more projects I've done, I can sort of see the flags And one thing that's helped a lot, I should say, is approaching a business in this way means that by and large, I get hired by people who consider themselves fans, which means it's already on a nice playing field. There's a mutual respect built there that doesn't always happen when a marketing team is working with a creative. So I feel like I'm already in a good place by structuring my business that way, that the leads come through that way. But generally, I look at, is the subject matter interesting to me? And I get interested by a wide variety of you know, sometimes bizarre industries. I like finding the sources of humor in those industries. So it's not necessarily something that I've had direct experience with. And sometimes when I'm learning about a new industry, that can actually appeal to me. But the first thing I look at is there something funny here? Can I find that there's a subculture or lenses of humor that I can play with in this industry or domain or audience type of group that would be an interesting challenge to work with? That's one sort of lens. And there are definitely red flags that can sometimes emerge in those areas. But the second thing really is the team. And who is on the team? Who is on the team briefing? Who is on the team reviewing? The number one thing is making sure there aren't too many cooks in the kitchen. And cartoons are particularly fragile. I think any form of creative expression is fragile, but cartoons in particular, if you try to layer on, you know, 10 points of feedback, you know, you can very, very quickly dilute the idea so that it may respond to all of that feedback, but you completely lose anything that made it funny.
I think this is the problem where often in creative work where people want to be involved. You want to scrawl your name in the cement before it dries on the sidewalk, kind of, when sometimes you should know that that's not your role in this particular project.
Exactly. And people mean well. And I've been on both sides of it. So I try to approach those situations first off with humor. You know, if I see it happening and I think we can move past it. But if I get an early read on a client briefing that this is not a good cultural fit, you know, one of the big things that can happen is you get a couple of people who are really excited and then they say, well, once we have the ideas, then we're going to take it through this gauntlet of people that you'll never meet. And I've seen that movie before and that just doesn't play well. And I thank them. I appreciate them thinking about me and I politely decline moving forward on the project. And it's just not worth it. I feel like in one sense, the choice I made in my business model to be deliberately, stay deliberately focused and small and not scale a big agency means that I actually have so much capacity for creative collaborations a year. And so anything that I would take up time with one that doesn't fit means that I wouldn't have the time to do my full effort on one that is a good fit. Yeah. And that helped me get a little bit that helped me feel more comfortable in saying no so that I can say enthusiastically yes more often.
On July 16th, four of the biggest names in the creator economy, being Sean Puri, Cody Sanchez, Chris Kerner, and Tyler Denk, are coming together for the Creator Business Summit. They've built seven-figure brands, scaled audiences, and turned content into companies. And now they're breaking down exactly how they did it. Whether you are just starting out or scaling fast, this free, live, and virtual event will give you the playbook to turn your audience into a real business. Don't miss it. Visit beehive.com/virtual-events to register for free. That's beehive.com/virtual-events. You did at one point try to experiment with starting an agency. I don't know how long this lasted, though. Can you tell me when you did that, why you did that, and then why and how you shut it down?
I did. Part of my initial motivation, I thought, if I'm doing this as a business, I need to grow it into a business, you know, with an office. And I saw a big gap between this incredible talent pool of cartoonists who are incredible storytellers and their traditional markets who've gone away. And I thought, I have this business background. I can be an intermediary between them. And I experimented at various points in bringing on other cartoonists onto specific projects or other teams or into part of what I did. And parts of that was interesting and gratifying. And I got to meet a lot of people. And I have such respect for cartoonists, you know, and had so much fun getting to know them personally. But I found myself turning into a glorified project manager. And it wasn't why I quit my job to follow a dream, ultimately, was to become a glorified project manager. And so that was the big shift, ultimately. I still do collaborations occasionally, particularly on things like animation, where I want to work with experts. But by and large, people want to work with me because they like my style, they like my approach, and I prefer that too. I prefer going deep with fewer clients rather than really in a shallow way across lots of clients.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. This aligns with another of my sort of definition, or like another of the angles of my definition of creator, which is somebody who has all the risk and the upside, right? Like you could be doing your job full time for a company. Then you're not really a creator in my book. You're kind of a cartoonist for this company. But when you're doing your own thing, this is where it gets into that entrepreneur thing. A creator is just another word for a certain type of entrepreneur who traffics in digital media, right? Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, as you do. I want to go to the speaking gigs for a second. We haven't really spent a lot of time on this. So tell me how this came to be. First, I have a guess. So one, that talk from 2011, that talk, is quite good. And you are really good at articulating your ideas. You have a very positive demeanor. People want to listen to you. This is why people ask you to consult for adding humor to leadership, right? You're a natural, suffice to say, in some ways. But how did you start like really sharpening this into like, oh, this is a thing that I do now that makes me a large portion of my revenue?
It was a complete surprise for me that this was even a thing. I used to speak as part of my job occasionally, you know, in various consumer packaged goods companies, particularly when I was with Method, which was a startup.
And you were an executive, right? Like you were a leader.
That was. And I would get invited to conferences and tell the Method story. And I started including my cartoons in those conferences and people responded to those. And I spoke at some big retail conference in the UK when I was living over there. And afterwards, the organizer said, you should actually be doing this as a living. You know, forget about this brand stuff. You've got something here with your speaking and your cartoons. And I was like, really? That's really a thing? And then right around the year that I quit my job to do the cartooning full time, I got invited to speak at South by Southwest. And I had a lot of fun doing that. But I also heard about this other session from somebody named Tim Saunders, who had written this book called Love is the Killer App. And it had on the cover of Fast Company magazine, and it launched his professional speaking career. And he gave a whole panel at South by Southwest on being a professional speaker. And I went to it just out of curiosity. And it completely blew my mind that there was this whole ecosystem of paid professional speakers. And I thought, that's really interesting. And so the light bulb went off for me. I wasn't sure how that could look, but I thought I'm gonna kind of test the waters. And occasionally I would get invited to speak places and I would just sort of lean into it. And then it's kept creeping up and growing over time. And I realized that while my dream had been, I can't wait to be a cartoonist and sit at the drafting table, getting to go to all these places and to speak in front of a crowd of 50 to, you know, 600-700 people, I love that. I love the opportunity to get in front of people directly. There was like an energy that I got from that part of my life that was different than my drafting table energy. And so I thought, I want to do both. And so I've been doing that ever since, really. But in the last 2 years, I decided I want to even take it up another level. And I started interviewing and talking to real A-level business keynote speakers to learn about their business practices in keynote speaking. I went through speaker training. I started to get more deliberate about the programs I have and the modules I offer to clients. And last year, it was 50% of my income. And I'm looking at trying to lean into that even more, because it really complements everything else that I do, but on its own, it's just really fulfilling.
Yeah. So one question in there, you said how you've been developing the modules and kind of packages you offer people, and you do a lot. You do these a lot. I don't know how many it is per year, but it's at least a dozen, I think, in the last year or something like that. But I was curious to ask, like, how you develop these speeches, how you bring in new ideas, because I listened to a couple and I've listened to you on a few podcasts, and like, there are these threads that you always pick up on and that are really polished and for a reason, right? It's like you go out there and you speak about like these specific ideas that are insightful to people and educational and entertaining and inspirational all in one. But my question was like how you bring in these new ideas and whether that's even necessary, or if people just want you to come and like speak on this thing that you have like just dialed in so well. So this modules and package development, how you bring in new insights. I'm really curious about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I approach it a couple of different ways. I look at different tracks people will be interested in. And my speaking has really evolved around, there's a marketing type of track, and there's an innovation type of track, and there's a adopting technology type of track. And then more recently, there's been a lot around, I've been speaking a lot about just business as a leadership. So it's kind of a culture building type of track. And with each one of those tracks, I have I kind of think of my talks with different modules or component pieces. And some of those modules, there's some evergreen modules that become, you know, I connect with so many groups, I realize they're really resonating over time. And I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I do want to keep it up to date. And so it, in some ways, that's benefited by the fact that I'm drawing a new cartoon every week. And so while I might have given a talk about how to adopt technology that was particularly relevant 10 years ago, there's a lot of new material because there are very specific things happening in relation to AI, for instance, that works within the mindset shift that's required in adopting new technology, but that's unique given the natures of AI. And right, you know, having a module on agentic AI, for instance, it can sometimes connect with some points I've been making for years about how quickly technology moves and how organizations are slow to catch up and the mindset to best be receptive for that type of change. But having it literally based on cartoons I created in the last 2 weeks. I'm speaking at two conferences next week and you know, I'm using cartoons I drew just 2 weeks ago. So I'm continually refreshing the content, but I'm also trying to leverage the benefits of having road tested material that I've been working on for the last, you know, 20 years now as well. And so it's really a combination. And ultimately I learn from the audience. It's when I draw a cartoon, you know, I send it out and I may see some metrics that say this is resonating in this way or another way, but there's nothing that compares to being on a stage and putting up a cartoon and being with a live audience and seeing how they respond to it. Mm-hmm. And so it's an integrated part of my overall creative process.
Yeah, no, this makes sense too. And I like what you're talking about like, you know, you may have done this talk a decade ago where you were speaking about this one technological shift and now it's just kind of the same thing with AI, but with different contexts. And, you know, I'm a big believer in this idea that there's kind of only so many ideas in the world, but it's just about putting them in new clothes and in new locations, right? That's kind of what it's about.
And it's one of the big, you know, things that I've observed. I mean, because I've been drawing this cartoon for 23 years now, it's one of the things that I can uniquely offer is a bit of a longer term vantage point. You know, I think we're very apt to say, you know, whatever example you may have come across 10 years ago is no longer relevant. And actually, you know, things do continually change, but there is a lot that are evergreen principles we sometimes forget. And we forget, it's a disadvantage to forget them because a lot of times there are hard won lessons and we can, in chasing the shiny new object, we can forget some of the truisms that are of use to everybody.
Yeah. Speaking of not chasing shiny new objects, I understand that part of your creative process is you'll listen to Miles Davis Kind of Blue every morning. Old album, one of my favorite albums, one of the best albums of all time, I would hazard to say.
I
like that you said you do this every morning because I'm definitely someone as well where I know that I am most, my brain is most creatively active from, let's say, like, you know, give or take a half hour or an hour from like 8:30 a.m. to noon. And then it can like 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. And then that's when I researched for this interview was in the morning. And, you know, when I'm writing a newsletter, I'll do that in the morning or in the evening. And then in the middle of the day is like a lot more of the, like, you know, answering my emails and all these other sorts of things that don't require me to like be coming up with new ideas rapidly. Right. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you structure your day as, you know, a solo creator, entrepreneur, creative entrepreneur, marketer, cartoonist, any of these words we want to say. How do you structure your day to get the best creative work out of yourself while also handling all the infrastructural work?
Yeah, I've learned to be pretty precious with a couple hours in particular every day. And those are those creative hours in the morning where I know I'm most creative. I know I in order to do what I do, I need that time. It's not optional. I can't just come up with cartoons in 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there between meetings. I have to set aside, you know, that Cal Newport deep thinking time. And so I made that a real priority. I find that, you know, early in the morning is best for me. I'm usually sort of a 8 in the morning to 10:30 window. You know, that's usually what I hold. That allows me to occasionally take a call before that because I have clients in Europe and in India. And so sometimes I have morning clients there, but by and large, I try to block that time as pretty sacred. And I find that creative rituals help. So listening to the same album over and over again, I never get tired of it. It's
how long? Wait, how long have you been doing Kind of Blue? How many years?
At least 15 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I never get tired of it. And I couldn't tell you the names of the songs in order. I mean, I kind of do. I've learned more about the album. I've read books about the album. And that album flows.
No, I feel it's funny. The way I work is I won't necessarily do that, but I will have like one song that I listen to on repeat all day for like 3 weeks at a time. And then I'll shift to another song or something like that. But it's, yeah, then it just gets me in the zone. And then eventually, like, somehow I've wrung all I can wring out of that song. And I have to, and then a new one comes along and I listen to that for, but it's often what, sometimes it's an album, but it's often just like 1 5-minute song.
It really helps. I find sometimes I'm feeling lazy. I'm creative. I think like my creative brain is lazy. It would rather like get distracted, like, oh, I should really clean up that table over there, or I should do something else. And so when I sit in the chair and I put the headphones on and the song kicks in, it's like telling my brain, okay, it's time to focus on this now. And I quickly forget any individual notes or parts of the song. It helps me get to, you know, quote unquote flow state quicker, where I'm not thinking at all. And it's 44 minutes long, so it's a good length of time for me to do deep creative work before I take a break and then come back and put it on again for another 44 minutes. And I have to come to that moment already having done my prep work. And so I have just folders filled with research on various projects. Mm-hmm. So I'll sit in the chair, take out the stimulus, and just start going through it with stacks of blank index cards. And play with ideas. And then when the 44 minutes is done, stick it in the envelope and I move on to another one. And I come back the next day, take out the same envelope, look at the ideas I had the day before, go through it slowly. And I find that works best with my creative process, to have dedicated time, allows me to be completely nonlinear in my ideas. I shuffle index cards around a lot. I throw out a lot of stuff. I draw stuff down. I read the next day. I'm like, I don't even remember coming up with this idea. But actually, if I connect it with that other idea over here, that could actually be something. And I have an intuition now that, oh, there's something in this place. I'm going to put it in a special pile.
Yeah.
And then I don't even know what the cartoon will be yet, but it's in the pile. And like after I do that for a number of subsequent days, I usually have a stack of ideas that are ready to ink and create the final versions of.
And these things are all connected.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's like creative exercise. I feel better as a human for having that time in my life to dedicate to pure, deep thinking time. It's the most productive time of my day by far. Yeah. Thankfully, my lazier parts of the afternoon day where I don't feel like thinking, that's when I get to sit at the drafting table and actually draw the ideas I've come up with. And that is not much thinking at all. I can put on podcasts and just like, I love, it's like the dessert of my day, just being able to draw ideas at that point.
The dessert of your day. And then the afternoon, so early.
Yeah, I know. For dessert. I know.
A couple more questions. One, so the way you talk about your work and like how you tried this agency at one point, you also, your general demeanor, you strike me as somebody who is not necessarily growth obsessed. You're a sensible person. You're not really a greedy person, I'm picking up. So I'm curious if like since you left your job, I think I read that after 9 months you'd replaced your salary. There was all this demand. I'm curious if like you've kind of grown your revenue every year, or if you got to a point where you're like, I don't necessarily, maybe I'm charging more for speaking gigs, or I'm doing a few more, but like I don't necessarily need to do more, because I'm always very interested in how people have created sustainable businesses, not things that are trying to be world eating. So did you kind of reach a point at some point where you're like, this is actually the speed I want to continue at, and I'm going to try to hold it here?
I did. And it was pretty early on. Part of the motivation of the business was to have that a little bit more in my control. Mm. I had my level. I knew I wanted to make at least, you know, this amount, like the salary I was leaving behind. That was sort of one threshold level. And it's been consistently, you know, at least 3 times that ever since. But it's been, but it was, you know, there's another line that's like, what is my enough, you know? I had been part of a couple high growth startups earlier in my life, and they were in some ways miserable experiences and in some ways didn't play out according to plan. I learned a lot. I'm grateful for the experience, but they were quick flashes in the pan. They seemed world changing, put a dent in the universe. And now there's some of them you wouldn't even know the name anymore. Like one of them in the late 90s in particular, it was one of the early internet development companies called IXL. They grew by roll up. They bought up these little web shops part of their IP is now part of Razorfish. So it eventually turned into Razorfish. But at the time, we were working a zillion hours and making this happen.
And the goalposts are always moving another football field away. Like,
yeah, exactly. And then, you know, and then I was like, oh my God, this is driving me nuts. So I applied to business school and I had my exit off ramp. And you know, it eventually collapsed, got delisted from NASDAQ, Chapter 11, the whole deal. And the funny epilogue is that when my kids were in school, they were using some education platform that was called IXL.com. And they actually bought the domain. So my kids every day were on the domain name of the company that just, you know, 15 years earlier, I thought was going to be the biggest world-changing company there was. And so those experiences, having a few startup experiences, made me realize that I wanted to create a life that was I had a different yardstick for success. Mm-hmm. And part of it was continuity over time. I wanted to build a certain kind of life for myself and my family. I wanted to do creative work that fills me up. I want to have my days that inspire me and will certainly have some challenges and things I have to deal with and everything else. It is work after all, but it's the model of success that works for me. And it doesn't have to be the model for other people. And so once I qualified and quantified what that looked like for me, it helped me realize that scale wasn't going to fix everything. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when I hit a good point where it was working, I'm just going to keep focusing on that. And so it hasn't been a hockey stick. It hasn't been even a steady growth up. There are years that are better and years that are lower, but they've all been above my enough level. And that works for me. I was able to really be part of my kids growing up and launch them into college. And, you know, we do home exchanges and spend a month in Europe. And I do a little work from over there. And all of those things kind of bundle together that really work for me and my type of business. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the great things about the creator economy is that you get to make your own rules.
Yes, that is awesome. That's actually, there's a book called Make Your Own Rules by this guy, Andrew Huang. I interviewed him a year and a half ago, and it's all about this. He's like, I think he's like 40, 41 or something. He never had a real job. So when he was like 19, at the end of starting up, he's a musician. He started selling his songwriting services on eBay. And that was how he started making money. And now he's like a big YouTuber and similar to you, will do client work and stuff like this. But you do it long enough and with enough care and obsession, you build up these sustainable businesses. One other thing I wanted to touch on before we stop is, so my last reference to that Do talk from 2011, which we'll have to link it in the comments. I've mentioned it enough times, but you mentioned when you were at Harvard Business School, your friend Prash, who was the editor of the Harvard Business School newspaper, and you told him that you wanted to be a cartoonist as a kid. And as you say, he hounded you for cartoons until you started making them for the paper. And the first time you did it, and it was electrifying for you. You know, it was that spark. And you say, I quote you here, the voice of what you want to do often comes from other people who are persistent, and you have to listen to people like Prash. And I think this line kind of speaks for itself, but I wanted to bring it in here at the end because I think one thing that's lost in the creator economy is people working solo and this idea of the solopreneur, which you've built this, you know, this life here. But I think for so many people, it is kind of a myth, and you need to work as a social endeavor, right? Like, and even you have clients and stuff that you work with. But just for that creative energy and that fact that work is ultimately a social endeavor, I thought that was a really moving story.
It made an impact on me, and it became, I remember that every time I hear from other people, that there's signs from the universe out there that are giving me pointers on other ways that I can grow and develop, you know, as a human, but also in my work. So that I think that's something I try to pay attention to. And I had the opportunity 2 years ago, I was invited to speak in Singapore, where Prash now lives. And he it turned out was going to be in the audience of my talk. And so I surprised him by putting up a photo of the two of us from decades earlier in business school together. And I told a little bit of that story about how he was the voice for me at that time. He's actually publishing a book right now and using a bunch of my cartoons in it.
That's awesome.
So the universe has funny ripples over time.
Mm-hmm. Listen to the universe. Sometimes it's speaking to you through your friend.
Yes.
I guess we'll stop here. Tom, this was great. Thank you for joining. Is there any, where should people go to find your work? It's marketoonist.com.
Yeah, marketoonist.com. And I love connecting with people on LinkedIn. So that's another great place to go. And of course, I have a weekly newsletter I send out every Monday morning.
Subscribe to it, folks. This has been Creator Spotlight. Thank you for listening.